This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Guy Pearce first became known to Americans for his role as a drag queen in the comedy Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. The Australian actor went on to star in the cop drama L.A. Confidential. In last year's independent film hit Memento, he played a man with a rare form of amnesia. Now Pearce is in two films currently in theaters, The Count of Monte Cristo and The Time Machine. Let's start with a scene from The Time Machine. Pearce plays a scientist at the dawn of the 20th century who invents a time machine. In this scene, he's traveled to the year 2030, where he meets a computerized hologram in the form of a human, which is a databank of the world's knowledge. The time traveler has some questions for the hologram, which is played by Orlando Jones.
Do you know anything about physics?
Ah, accessing physics.
Mechanical engineering. Dimensional optics, phrenography, temporal causality, temporal paradox.
Time travel?
Yes.
Accessing science fiction?
No, practical application. My question is, why can't one change the past?
Because one cannot travel into the past.
What if one could?
One cannot.
Excuse me, this is something you should trust me on.
Soon after this encounter, Pearce gets back into the time machine and eventually lands 800,000 years into the future, where he finds that humans are the prey of underworld creatures that he will soon have to battle. Now, one of the things I imagine you don't learn in acting classes is how to wrestle with monsters or creatures in a movie.
So, if I had, I wouldn't have broken my rib doing it.
Oh, did you break a rib doing it?
Yes, I did.
What happened?
Well, I just have to run in and attack one of these monsters and one of these Morlocks. And after having done it about 15 or 20 times, I started to realize I was in a serious amount of pain and had actually cracked one of my left front ribs, so it was most uncomfortable for a while after that.
Could you keep shooting?
Well, we did. I mean, I had to sort of pare down what I had to do, and ironically, it was around the time that Simon, our director, needed to sort of step away from the shoot, and so when he did that, we ended up having a 2-week break while the replacement, the sort of temporary replacement director came in, you know. So it actually worked out quite well that I could have 2 weeks of sitting around at home without trying to climb towers and wrestle more Morlocks, you know.
I was reading some article about the making of Time Machine, and it was, I think it was a studio executive maybe, who said that they had a feeling that although you hadn't done this kind of film before, that you could really be a hero. I thought, look, okay, when you take on a role, and you really are the hero in this. I mean, you save a whole race of people. How did you prepare yourself to play the part of the pure hero?
It's stepping out of, I suppose, the reality of what a person does. I mean, it's funny in a way, because I don't consider myself at all to be heroic, and I think it's a term that gets used far more in the United States than it does in Australia, and so it's an unusual term for me, hero. You know, I remember in L.A. Confidential, in that final sort of speech that I have, and I'm sitting in the interrogation room, I have to say to the guys, you know, you'll have to find another hero, and I'm kind of talking about myself, and I remember having to try and really understand what that meant, you know. And it's about cultivating the childlike quality within your mind or your imagination or your perspective that enables you to be able to look at people as heroes or bad guys or whatever. You know, to me, there is a sort of a naive childlike quality to that viewpoint, you know.
Let me ask you about Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. This is the movie that Americans first got to know you through.
And yes, I guess so.
In this part, you play a drag queen. The premise of the movie is that one of your friends who is a drag queen gets a part in a drag show at a resort in a town in the remote Australian desert. So this friend invites you and another friend who's a transsexual, played by Terrence Stamp, to go with him. So the movie is like your journey across the outback in this old bus that you name Priscilla. Let me play a short scene. In this scene, The transsexual, played by Terrence Stamp, is not very happy that you were invited along. The scene opens with you singing.
A desert holiday, let's pack the drag away. You take the lunch and tea, I'll take the ecstasy. F*** off, you silly queer, I'm getting out of here. A desert holiday, hip, 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 hooray.
Why?
Why not?
Look, he's turned into a bloody good little performer.
That's right. A bloody good little performer. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I thought we were getting away from all this shit.
Two's company, three's a party, Bernadette, my sweet.
We're unplugging our curling wands and going bush, Felicia. Why would you possibly want to leave all this glamour for a hike into the middle of nowhere?
Do you really want to know?
Desperately.
Well, ever since I was a lad, I've had this dream. A dream that I now, finally, have a chance to fulfill.
And that is?
To travel to the center of Australia, climb King's Canyon, as a queen, in a full-length Gautier sequin, heels and a tiara.
So, Guy Pearce, what are the favorite costumes that you actually did have to wear for Priscilla?
I think one of the funniest ones, or the funniest situation really, was the when we finally arrive in King's Canyon and we are there on the top of the this precipice that was really quite high. We were unable to hike up there. We had to actually be flown up there by a helicopter and dropped off. And I was wearing a fluffy white G-string and a funny fluffy hat. And sitting on the outside of the helicopter, I wasn't even inside the helicopter, to sit outside on this bar on the outside of it, being flown up into King's Canyon. So I have a really unusual memory of that costume and how uncomfortable it is to sit on the outside of a helicopter in a fluffy white G-string. But they were all brilliant, really. I mean, they were such fabulous additions, I suppose, and helpful elements to our characters. They were great.
What was it like for you to wear drag? I mean, did it bring out certain, like, different parts of your personality? Did you automatically start walking differently, talking differently?
I think so. I mean, we, in some ways, it's about needing to shed any masculinity in a way when you're wearing that garb, because that then becomes kind of comical, I suppose, you know. We actually, when we first did our camera tests and makeup and wardrobe tests, we had all decided prior to that that we were going to go out in Sydney in drag that night, go to some clubs, get drunk and have a fab old time, you know, and which we did. And it was really the first time. We'd been in rehearsals for a couple of weeks, but we'd been wearing jeans and tracksuits and whatever, you know. And so it was the first time that it really came to life. And so much of that is about in wearing those costumes and those shoes and the wigs and everything. And just, I suppose, you know, I mean, being an actor in Australia and being recognised, when you're in drag, you're in disguise as well. And so you suddenly feel inconspicuous, so you can kind of get away with doing whatever you want, you know.
My guest is actor Guy Pearce. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Guy Pearce, and he's now starring in The Time Machine. Well, Guy Pearce, let me get to another one of your roles, and this is in the film L.A. Confidential. Mm-hmm. And in this you play Ed Exley, a cop who's pretty clean-cut and self-righteous and very butch, not at all like your role in Priscilla. And you're very ambitious, and you're willing to do anything to get ahead, as long as it's by the book. And your ambition and your kind of political know-how make you unpopular with a lot of your colleagues. You get a promotion for supposedly solving a mass murder at the Night Owl Diner, but as more evidence surfaces, you begin to think you got the wrong guys. And in this scene, you want to reinvestigate that murder, and you're seeking the help of a fellow cop played by Kevin Spacey.
Do you make the three Negroes for the Night Owl killings?
What?
It's a simple question.
Why in the world do you want to go digging any deeper into the Night Owl killings, Lieutenant?
Rollo Tomasi.
Is there more to that, or am I supposed to guess?
Rollo was a purse snatcher. My father ran into him off duty. And he shot my father 6 times and got away clean. No one even knew who he was. I just made the name up to give him some personality.
What's your point?
Rollo Tomasi's the reason I became a cop. I wanted to catch the guys who thought they could get away with it. It was supposed to be about justice. Then somewhere along the way, I lost sight of that. Why'd you become a cop?
I don't remember. What do you want, Exley?
I just want to solve this thing.
Night Owl was solved.
No. I want to do it right.
That's my guest, Guy Pearce, along with Kevin Spacey, in a scene from L.A. Confidential. Now, Russell Crowe was also in this movie with you. So here you have a movie set in L.A., and two of the stars are Australian, you and Russell Crowe. How did that happen?
Well, if you really want to get technical about it, I'm actually English, and Russell's from New Zealand. So,
okay, so you were born in England, and
yeah, I was born in England. Russell was born in New Zealand, and we admittedly, well, I grew up in Australia from the age of 3, and I think Russell came to Australia when he was about 21.
Huh.
So yes, we're Aussies.
Right. So, did you have to convince Curtis Hanson, the director of L.A. Confidential, that you could sound quite American?
Well, I mean, obviously I had to, and that just occurred in the original reading that I went to. I was literally just one of however many people coming in to screen test, and I found by that point, I mean, that was early '96, and I'd spent, you know, a couple of visits throughout '95 going to meetings and auditioning for people and this, that and the other, and one of the interesting things was that every time I went to a meeting and spoke the way I normally speak, it seemed to cause a bit of difficulty for people because they would say, oh, well, you might be able to work in this country, but you're going to have to lose that accent. So I started going to meetings and readings and just affecting an American accent.
So for you, what defines an American sound? I mean, to me, as someone who really only speaks English, it's like it's all I know is American English. And so that seems to be like the basic to me. For you, it's something different that you have to learn. What defines American English to you as opposed to Australian English?
Well, there are so many different kind of American accents and different kind of Australian accents. It's hard to say. I mean, I guess the first and most obvious general thing is the R sound. I mean, you would say car, and we would say car. And that is the most basic, as I say, in sort of simple difference. But funnily enough, there are some similarities, I guess, in tone and pitch and melody between, say, the Southern American accents, you know, the sort of Texas, the slang, the slow kind of, you know, the laconic kind of quality, to some of the Northern Australian accents. The Queenslanders up there kind of talk like that, you know. I mean, there are different shapes of words and sounds, but there are many places that actually have great similarities. But it could just be that simple thing, as I say, of saying R instead of ah.
Did you have a language coach, or did you just pick this up on your own?
Oh, look, we watch so much American television as kids in Australia and so many American films that you become quite attuned to it, you know.
Did you know Russell Crowe before L.A. Confidential?
Not very well. Russell had come and done a guest spot on a TV show that I did back in '85. And then the last time I'd seen Russell, he headbutted me in a bar in Sydney in about 1992, I think. So that was, I didn't know him very well.
Right. Why did Russell Crowe headbutt you?
I asked him that very same question, and he said he was trying to get my attention.
There are other ways.
Yes, but not as unpredictable as a headbutt.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Guy Pearce, and his films include Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, L.A. Confidential, Memento, The Count of Monte Cristo, and now The Time Machine. You were born in England, but you grew up in Australia. What brought your family from England to Australia?
My father was a fairly well-renowned test pilot in the UK. He'd worked in the Royal Air Force and worked for Hawker Siddeley. He was the chief test pilot for the Harrier jump jet and had also worked as a test pilot for the Canberra and Lockheed Lightning and various other fairly well-renowned aircraft. I think at the time we were in the UK living in Bristol, he was offered a job as the chief test pilot for the government aircraft factories in Australia to test a new aircraft, which was a short takeoff and landing aircraft called the Nomad. We took the job. He took the job. It was really just for a two-year stint. But after that 2 years, Mum, who was from England, and my dad, who was originally from New Zealand, didn't want to go back to England. They decided that, you know, Australia was more in line with the kind of life they wanted to live. So we stayed in Australia, and then that was in about 1971, and Dad was then killed testing an aircraft in 76, but we obviously still stayed in Australia.
When your father was killed testing an aircraft, what happened? The plane crashed?
Yeah, it was a they were testing a new long version of the aircraft. It literally took off. It was in the air for about 90 seconds. And due to sort of government pressures, they had to test these aircraft prior to them actually being ready to be tested. They usually go through a series of wind tunnel tests, et cetera, before they take them up in the air. So they took this aircraft up in the air, 90 seconds in the air. Most of the tail came off, and, of course, the aircraft just plummeted immediately, and my father and the designer were killed, and the navigator is now, unfortunately, he's still alive, but unfortunately is a paraplegic.
Had you braced yourself for something like that?
No, I was eight. I hadn't really conceived of such a notion, I suppose, until it actually occurred.
What impact did, I mean, did it leave you very afraid? Obviously, I'm sure you're very shaken up that you'd lost your father, but in terms of your own actions, did it leave you afraid to try new things? Because, like, look what happened to your father. He was killed on the job doing something adventurous.
I think it actually, in a rather morbid way, probably makes one more of a daredevil in when it comes to taking risks or whatever. And that's, as I say, from a sort of a morbid perspective. I mean, there's a desperate part of me that is trying to understand who my father was. And the fact that he went to that extreme and ended up dying because of it, I guess does kind of make you have a rather morbid fascination with extremes. I mean, I certainly don't have a fear of flying. I fly all the time and I really enjoy it. And funnily enough, after Dad died, I remember my mother saying to me, "Oh, you're such a responsible young boy, he's so responsible." And I've got an intellectually disabled sister, and there's really just the three of us, my mum and Tracy, my sister, and I. And so from a very young age, I was placed in the seat of responsibility, I suppose, in regard to taking care of myself and taking care of my sister. And I don't know, I guess in conjunction with that, or as a balance to that, there's a part of me that wants to let go of that responsibility and go and take risks. And of course, you know, being on stage in front of people or being in films that are presented to lots of people is not life-threatening, but it's certainly risk-taking to a certain extent.
My guest is Guy Pearce. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Guy Pearce. He starred in last year's independent film hit Memento, which is nominated for an Oscar for Best Screenplay. Pearce plays Leonard Shelby, a man who is trying to find out who murdered his wife, but the trauma has left him with a rare form of amnesia that prevents him from making new memories. Here he is with a shadowy figure who is helping him, played by Joe Pantoliano.
Leonard, look, you have to be very careful.
Why?
The other day you mentioned that maybe somebody was trying to set you up, get you to kill the wrong guy.
Oh, well, I go on facts, not recommendations, but thank you.
Lenny, you can't trust a man's life to your little notes and pictures.
Why not?
Because your notes could be unreliable.
Memory's unreliable.
Oh, please.
No, really. Memory's not perfect. It's not even that good. Ask the police. Eyewitness testimony is unreliable. The cops don't catch a killer by sitting around remembering stuff.
Right.
They collect facts.
That's not what I'm saying.
They make notes and they draw conclusions. Facts, not memories. That's how you investigate. I know. It's what I used to do. Look, memory can change the shape of a room. It can change the color of a car. and memories can be distorted. They're just an interpretation, they're not a record. And they're irrelevant if you have the facts.
You really want to get this guy, don't you?
He killed my wife. He took away my f***ing memory. He destroyed my ability to live.
How did you know you wanted to act?
The only recollection I really have was from a very young age, probably about that time, 8, 9, 10. My mother used to take me to a lot of theatre. She was a big fan of theatre. And we would go and see all sorts of a variety of stuff. And I feel like I have this memory as a kid of watching these productions and wanting to be up there affecting people the way I was being affected by the characters on stage. Wanting to... I suppose, was so moved by the conviction that those characters had in the performance that they were doing,
but
found that incredibly appealing.
But at the age of 16, you won a state bodybuilding championship. Why were you heading in that direction, and how big were those muscles?
Not so big. Well, I started, yet again, this is, I guess it was another influence of my mother. She started going to the gym when I was about 14 or 15, and I just went along with her. I mean, I played group sport at school, but I was very much an individual and very much spent a lot of time on my own or with my sister. And so I started going to this gym and just started working out and just trying to get fit, you know. And the gym that we went to was owned and was run by a married couple who were, one, she was a runner-up Miss Universe a couple of times, and the husband, Joe, was a judge for the IFBB, the International Federation of Bodybuilding. So I was quite exposed to the world of bodybuilding at a pretty young age, and he basically would say to me, the work that you're doing, the physical work you're doing is having quite an amazing immediate response, and, you know, if you want to consider it, then, you know, we should enter you in some competitions. And, you know, I saw competitions and I would see the videos of these competitions. And to me, it was kind of, I guess, yet another form of being on stage and performing, you know. And I was fascinated with the whole notion of actually creating yourself. And I still am, not so much in actually bodybuilding, but I'm more interested in spiritually creating or developing yourself or physically, you know, creating yourself in the characters that I play.
Yeah, but if you spiritually develop yourself, you can't show off like if you've got lots of muscles.
No, that's right. Hence the reason why I'm not so interested in bodybuilding anymore.
So do you still have muscles as big as they were then, or did you let them...
No, well, you saw Memento. I didn't have my shirt on much in that. You know, I certainly...
Well, after seeing your cheekbones, you know, I was going to tell you, you need to eat more.
I get told that all the time, so I'm kind of used to that now.
Now, when you were 18, you were cast in a nighttime soap opera in Australia called Neighbours. I have not seen the show. I doubt many Americans have. I read that you became a teen heartthrob. Fair description?
Well... To a certain extent. I mean, you know, I think, you know, the dog on the show is really popular as well. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's just that thing of being on a show that's watched by lots of teenagers. They tend to get a big excited about seeing you in real life. Or you know, there was obviously a lot of stuff with us on magazine covers, etc. You know, there was a bunch of us in the show. It wasn't like it was just me or anything.
Right, right. Well, you know, when you're a star at that age and teenagers fantasize about you, I'm sure they fantasize about this just incredibly interesting, constantly, you know, very sexy kind of life. Did you often think about what your real life was like compared to what your fans were probably imagining your life was like?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was a complete loner, you know. I mean, I spent a lot of time at home on my own and really didn't have a great social life. And I found that going out in public was even more difficult then than it was when I was even younger, because suddenly I would get recognized and hassled and confronted or just questioned, or I just didn't deal with the intention very well, I suppose. And so I then started to cultivate a really sort of small, intimate group of friends, and I would spend a lot of time at home on my own. And music has been a really important part of my life. So I really spent a lot of time recording music at home and working in my studio and rehearsing music, etc. So that's what I did.
And is this music, singing, playing, both?
Singing primarily, but playing, dabbling in a variety of instruments. And I became very interested in the notion of recording and the sort of technical aspect of recording and arranging. And I would have other musicians come over and play. And, you know, that still goes on, really. It's like a glorified hobby.
But you don't have a CD, a professional CD, right?
No, no. And I don't, you know, it's funny, as the years go on, the need to actually get it out publicly like that is sort of diminishes, I guess. I mean, I play gigs at home and just random stuff, you know. The nice thing about it is it actually makes one really question why music is such an important part of one's life and why one feels the need to express, you know, why I feel the need to express myself through music. And it is just about that, expressing myself through music and playing music with other people and rehearsing with other people or recording, but not turning it into, not taking it into that public arena and sort of turning yourself into a known entity because of it, you know.
Well, Guy Pearce, thank you so much for talking with us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Guy Pearce is now starring in The Time Machine and The Count of Monte Cristo.